You're listening to a Hit Row Z podcast for hitrowz.com, the best new source of football analysis and insight on the internet. www.hitrowz.com. Hello and welcome to the Hit Row Z podcast. My name's Ben and I'm joined by James.
Hello.
And we're here to dissect, discuss and debate the big news from the world of football. And as we're now less than 100 days away from the kickoff of the World Cup in Brazil, we'll also be starting a brand new feature for the show, the Hit Row Z World Cup Legends. But before that, James, let's look at the here and now. Wigan in the FA Cup, Tim Sherwood in Tottenham, Manchester United and Moyes have all been dominating the football news agenda. Where should we begin?
Let's begin with the FA Cup.
Sounds good.
Arsenal through to the semi-final with a fantastic win at home to Everton. A surprise in terms of the other three teams there. We've got Wigan, Sheffield United and Hull. Who's going to stop Arsenal?
I mean, it would be a brave person to bet against Arsenal now. But, I mean, in a strange sort of a way, the pressure's on them. Yeah. There's no excuses.
Can they win it?
They should win it.
Yeah, they're the favourites, aren't they?
They are, and I think what's encouraging for me about Arsenal and their chances of winning the FA Cup is their league campaign this season has really been built upon getting results against teams lower down the league than themselves.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, they've been consistent against sides that don't have the quality that they do.
Yeah.
And for me, that bodes very well when they come up against a team like Wigan or either Sheffield United or Hull in the final, that they'll be able to do the business.
Yeah. And if it is a sort of shoe-in for Arsenal, does that mean the romance and the magic of the FA Cup is over?
I think on the one hand, Arsenal will win it this year. You know, there's a great story in that. That it'll be Wenger's first trophy in you know the best part of a decade, and that's you know something which will make newspaper columns, but I mean I would question much more broadly than this semi-final draw this season that actually the romance of the FA Cup disappeared a long time ago. And even where we've had individual instances of giant killings or sides, even Wigan winning it last year.
Yeah.
You know, was no doubt it was romantic and special for the fans of Wigan.
Yeah.
But you just look more broadly at the health of the competition and, you know, clubs are resting players very regularly for the FA Cup. It's not really a priority for them.
Even Southampton did against Sunderland, wasn't it?
Exactly. And you'd think for them that would be a great opportunity to win some silverware, but they're not prioritising it.
Yeah, especially given their league position where they're not going to go up and they're probably not going to go down.
Exactly.
From where they are at the moment. They could have really went for that.
But they chose not to.
Yeah.
You then think about, you know, fans. Do fans care about the FA Cup? Well, attendances are down.
Yeah.
Most of the time, clubs have to induce fans to come and watch the games with discounts.
Yeah. Although I think fans would love a trip out to Wembley for the FA Cup.
It would. But it's interesting that they don't seem to be that enthusiastic about the earlier rounds. And that, no doubt, is partly because they don't know whether that manager will play the full-strength team in that game or not and how seriously the club's taking it. So, you know, all of that combines, really. I think that there are special moments within the competition.
Yeah.
Wigan this weekend, definitely one of them. Sheffield United reaching a semi-final despite being in League One. Fantastic.
Yeah.
But does it really generate a buzz? Does it dominate the English game anymore? Not really.
Yeah, it's quite short-lived because obviously Wigan did well last year. You've had other good cup runs, the likes of Millwall and Portsmouth, who went on to win it. And you remember those finals, I think it must have been in the 90s now when we were younger, Everton, Man United, Paul Ryder is
absolutely
grabbing a goal. And those were great days, weren't they? But still probably not as romantic as...
But I think that was probably, in my sort of football memory, is probably the last great romantic final I can remember, because it was I remember it as a really big occasion in the football calendar.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was because the Champions League or the European Cup at the time wasn't as big as it is now, because they couldn't get into it through the top four places in the division. This was one of the kind of the landmark moments of the season. This was a kind of a chance to play in Europe, one of, you know, a major piece of silverware, and the nation's attention was focused on it.
Yeah. And I think a couple of things that have dampened that, for me anyway. First of all, the semi-finals, they're played at Wembley
now.
And I remember when they used to be played at sort of random places like Villa Park. And that used to be a good, you know, you're going playing on a neutral ground, that used to be a good day out for fans. And the carrot of Wembley still dangled. Obviously now the commercials of the whole thing have changed, and Wembley needs as many games as possible, so it takes up the semis. And then there's also the fact that the FA Cup used to be the finale of the season, last game.
Exactly.
And you know, the season would finish and then everyone would go again for the FA Cup final. And I think last year Wigan played the FA Cup final a week and a half before they played their last game in the league, and they, you know, they still needed to win the games in the league to stay up. And I think that just takes the shine off the romance of the FA Cup as well.
Well, it does, and it actually puts managers in a position where they have to take pretty difficult decisions, actually, depending on where they are in the league.
Yeah.
Because of the financial rewards of being in the Premier League, of course they have to preference that.
There's an interesting paradox, though, isn't there? Because, I mean, on the one hand, we're saying that clubs are playing weakened sides in the FA Cup, but then on the other hand, a lot of the strong Premier League teams, or you know, from the quarterfinal stage onwards, tends to be dominated by Premier League sides. So they're playing weaker sides on the one hand, but still making progress throughout the competition.
It is, and I mean, you know, I wonder if it does ultimately just reflect the growing disparity between the top division and the squads of top division sides and the rest. But then you think about it, and actually this season, it goes against that rule of thumb, doesn't it? But, you know, I guess another question on all of this is, does it matter? You know, people lament this every season. We've lost the romance of the FA Cup.
Yeah.
It used to be so much better, with rose-tinted specs on, looking back at finals in the past and whatnot. Is the game genuinely poorer in England because we've lost a bit of that?
I don't think so. I think in large part, it's not about the winning. I don't think that's the romantic of the FA Cup. Isn't about winning the FA Cup. Although for fans, you know, a day out at Wembley and watching a team win must be fantastic. But really, it's about pitting a non-league side against a Premier League side in the third round. That's the romance of the FA Cup for me. Given sort of the average players like you and I, who might play at a weekend, giving them the chance of a day out at Old Trafford. That's fantastic. That's the romance of the FA Cup. Having those fans go to those big stadiums and enjoying themselves.
Yeah.
You know, they don't have to go all the way and they don't have to win it.
So would another instance of FA Cup magic, though, not be what the average Newcastle fan this season might say to you as well? All right, or indeed Southampton, which you brought up earlier. We can't win the league this season. We know that.
Yeah.
We're probably not going to get relegated either. But this is a chance to take something from the season.
Yeah.
And therefore it's important to us, and therefore we're gonna really go for it.
Yeah.
And actually, if we had a cup run like that, then that would be really important for the stature of the club.
Yeah. I think every club will set its own objectives at the start of the season. As a fan, I would love the objective of my club to be to have a good cup run and to really give the cup competitions a go. As you've said, the Premier League is really the be-all and end-all. You have to be in the Premier League, otherwise... you look at QPR and their sort of recent financial results. Obviously, some of that's self-inflicted, but really you do have to be in the Premier League to give you a chance of being a sustainable club. And then as a manager, you therefore prepare your team and you use your squad for the Premier League. And it's probably no surprise that you're going to play your best players in your Premier League games, because those are the most important. And actually, as a manager, you're still responsible for a squad of players.
Yeah.
And you're going to have to use that resource, you know, whether it's to rest your stronger players so you can play the following week against your Premier League rivals, or even if it's just for the morale of the squad to make sure everybody's feeling included, they're part of the group. And that's where the man management comes into it. And unfortunately, perhaps the FA Cup and League Cup have fallen into, you know, they're there to help the manager manage his squad.
Yeah. And so back to this season's FA Cup, who do you see contesting the final?
I think it'll be Arsenal Hull. And I really think that Hull will give Arsenal a good game.
Yeah,
I think Steve Bruce is having a fantastic season there, exceeding all expectation. I don't think he'd expect to be in the semi-final or sort of going to Wembley for a second time for the final. Yeah, I think they're having a great season. I think they'll give it a really good go.
I still think Arsenal are going to win it, though.
Well, they'll be the favourites, but I'm a romantic.
Moving on from the FA Cup then, James, Tim Sherwood gave a rather bombastic interview after his Premier League game this weekend at Stamford Bridge away from home to Chelsea. Spurs capitulated again against a top side, losing 4-0 after having actually kept Chelsea out for the best part of an hour.
Yeah.
What's going on at Tottenham?
It's very hard to say. Tim Sherwood, you know, you're right to say, give a bit of a crazy interview after the game, actually. I wasn't expecting it, because although he got thumped, there was a refereeing decision, that cost them really, and a couple of individual errors. But I thought his interview was really insightful, actually. He mentioned the silence being deafening. Nobody's coming out to support him. He mentioned that you want top four, well, you're dreaming. That's not going to happen. And then he also reflected on his own role and suggested that he wouldn't want to be an assistant manager if they brought someone else in, but he might want a different place in the club hierarchy. And all that, to me, just first of all, suggests that Tim Sherwood is feeling the heat a little bit.
Yeah.
And perhaps rightly so, because he stepped in after AVB was having a similarly bad run of form against the top sides. But for me, it really just makes you question what's going on at Spurs. Now, reading between the lines there, it seems clear to me that the board and the fans of Tottenham Hotspur want the club to get top four.
Yeah.
And fans especially, rightly so. They've been there or thereabouts for a few seasons now. And they seemed to be in a position where they could push. They'd be very disappointed that Liverpool have leapfrogged them.
Yeah. Well, particularly in the context of selling their best player.
Yeah, selling their best player and spending a fortune in the summer, which I think really, you start looking at the role that Daniel Levy and Baldini are playing at that club. My understanding is that they hold the purse strings and they identify the players and they go out and get the players. Now, a frustration for them must be when they spend the best part of 100 million on new players. They look at Andre Villas-Boas and Tim Sherwood and they're not playing them. They're not playing them in their starting 11. Is that a waste of money? Is there been a breakdown of communication between the manager and Levy and Baldini? What's went wrong there? Why have they spent so much money on players playing?
What will definitely disturb them most, I suppose, is the fact that Sherwood's continued to not play some of the players that Villas-Boas just didn't fancy. And so you think about that, and actually it's not just a peculiarity of AVB and his relationship with the player. There's something fundamental there. That's what that says to me. And a great example of that is Eriksen, who was brought in from the cold by Sherwood when he first came in.
Yeah.
Did reasonably well, some assists, some goals, but is now not even making the first 16.
Yeah, that's right. And I think the big criticism sort of from the armchair fan and pundits of AVB was his formation. Yeah. He's isolating Soldado, not creating chances, he's not putting the ball in the net. You watch Spurs at the weekend and they didn't create very many chances either.
Yeah.
Petr Cech had a very easy day, really. They didn't create many chances. No. Soldado didn't play. Spurs look like a very similar team to the one that AVB had, in the sense they're pretty good at keeping the ball, but they're very blunt, and they didn't look like scoring at all at the weekend.
No, it's confusing, really, in terms of what the long term plan at that club is, because you don't really appoint a manager like AVB if you're not trying to build for the longer term. All that man says, and all he surely said in his job interview for that post, was, I want a project that's going to last a long period of time, which I can shape, and I'll take you up the league as a result. And so, firstly, to sack him, despite having a 50-odd% win ratio, was strange to me.
Yeah.
But then to rush into appointing a man with no previous Premier League experience, and I don't know Tim Sherwood that well, but it doesn't surprise me, really, that he's very temperamental. I've always kind of figured that he was a little bit. And now he's having a kind of very obvious pop at the owner.
Yeah. Is there something to be said? Is there something to be said for Spurs appointing a more experienced manager? Because I think what they really want to do there, they're clearly adopting this continental model where they've got a director of football who's responsible for player recruitment. And what they really need, I think Levy does have a long term strategy. But is he being let down by the man that he's picking to run the team, the manager? They've appointed Tim Sherwood. He's got no managerial experience and no experience of building teams and implementing a long-term strategy. Similarly, Andre Villas-Boas, I think his reign at Spurs, a year and a third or whatever it was the longest managerial reign of his career.
Yeah.
Similarly, he's got no experience in building teams and proving he's in it for the long haul. I don't doubt he's got the ideas and the philosophies and the approaches, but he's not done it.
Yep.
Would Spurs be wise to actually take another look at this in the summer and perhaps bring in somebody with a bit more experience, perhaps a bit more experience with how this model works as well, and buys into the vision and buys into what their role at the club is, and actually helps to build the team.
There may well be something in that. What I would say to it is, I think in AVB and Tim Sherwood, actually, they've probably got two guys who, although they do lack experience, are probably up for playing that role.
Yeah.
They probably don't have any illusions as to the extent of their control within recruitment or dictating those kind of terms.
Yeah.
And so should be ideal candidates for it. And so with that in mind, then, that suggests to me that there's a breakdown between the manager, the coach, and the director of football and the hierarchy as to who those players should be and what kind of system they're going to fit into.
Yeah.
And a case in point has to be the recruitment of Soldado for me. All right, he actually played, unlike Lamella, etc. But I think that was probably out of necessity because clearly AVB's relationship with Adebayor had broken down. Never really looks like a player who's going to fit into AVB's system.
Yeah.
And so why are you lashing out $25 million on him?
Yeah, so it feels like there's been a breakdown in communication or whatever it is between the manager and between the player recruitment side.
Because
if
the coach's job is just to work with the players that he's got, he must have a role in, if not sign off of, the players that are being brought in.
Yeah.
Because otherwise you risk wasting a lot of money on players that the coach has no intention of playing.
Which is
exactly what happened. Yeah. And I mean, you know, Tim Sherwood obviously hasn't had that luxury. He's just coming in to deal with the squad. And it strikes me that he would, given that he wants the job, he would play the best possible side that he feels he can field, almost irrespective of the politics of it.
Yeah.
He's got no interest in messing around in that sense. And he's still not playing those players.
No, it's really interesting. I mean, he's playing the likes of Bentaleb. He was just a young guy. He's actually a very, very good player, but it's someone who Tim Sherwood trusts.
Yeah.
But Sherwood's picking him ahead of much more established stars or, you know, players with bigger reputations, basically.
Yeah.
So I think Tim Sherwood's being very brave in some of his team selections.
Absolutely.
So I agree wholeheartedly with you. If he thought that he had better alternatives, then he'd surely be using them. But I guess that just, again, you know, if Tim Sherwood is the manager, thinks Bentaleb is a better option for him than Kapue or Sandro or Paulinho or any other combination of those players, or Holtby, what's going wrong with the recruitment strategy? They shouldn't be spending all that money if they've already got the players.
Absolutely.
There.
Absolutely right. And so if you're, you know, to go back to your challenge of, well, would it be better if they had a more experienced manager? Potentially, I guess, one who could really, you know, demonstrate his weight in those conversations, perhaps, with Baldini and with Levy.
Yeah.
You know, actually have the credibility to say, no, you don't want to go after that player, it should be this player.
Yeah.
And I know that because I've spent 4 years managing at the top of the game.
Yeah.
Then maybe that would improve matters. You know, maybe that dynamic would feel more equal, as opposed to appointing managers who feel lucky to have the job. Because, you know, there's no doubt AVB, you know, I can imagine that AVB would feel grateful to have that Spurs job because he'd just come out of a disaster at Chelsea.
Yeah.
And as you said, he'd never lasted at a club longer than 12 months.
I suppose the big issue that fans have in all of these discussions, and certainly as a Newcastle fan, I understand that as well. You know, it's really understandable, you know, what are the terms of reference for the manager's job, and the terms of reference for Baldini's job? And as you say, you know, is the manager involved in the decision? If the manager says no, does that mean no? Or does the manager have to say yes for things to actually go through?
Well, absolutely. And if he's not, can he really be held responsible if things go wrong?
Yeah, because I think it sounds like it should be a collective agreement is probably the right one.
Yeah.
But
then the whole club has to stand behind that.
They have to stand behind it. But I think why that works for this is clearly the idea, or one of the ideas behind a director of football, is you've got somebody who's looking after, or should be looking after, the long-term interests and strategic direction of the club. And I don't think that doesn't stop the manager from saying, hang on, I think we should sign this player. But it does mean that the director of football reserves the right to say, no, that's not the kind of player we want to go in this direction. How about these three players? Do you like any of them? Yes or no? If not, we'll go back to the drawing board and we'll find some more. But I think it is a good check to have in on the manager's power. Because he doesn't have to go out and spend an absolute fortune on a player that he fancies. But the next manager might not. So I do think it's a decent check to have in there on the manager's power. But I think there is still some sort of conundrum or tension that needs to be played out before we're going to see the success of this director football manager model.
But it's quite interesting as well, though, to add in as well. Yes, the director of football is clearly there to try and provide some institutional certainty, some consistency. You know, being there for the long haul and have a longer term strategic vision for the place. But increasingly, you're seeing those characters move.
Yeah.
And so, you know, Camoli, who was at Liverpool, had previously been at Spurs, had been at Arsenal. West Brom have just lost their sort of longer-term technical director. And actually, there's no guarantee that those people will stay in post for the length of time that you'd quite like them to. There's a market in directors of football just as there are in managers.
Yeah, that's right. That is, again, another risk that needs to be dealt with.
So, in terms of, you know, back to what Tottenham are going to do now and for the rest of this season, I don't imagine Levy will have taken Sherwood's comments particularly well. In some respects, one might argue they were kind of refreshingly honest. But to me, I agree with you. I think it just seemed like the pressure was getting to him a bit. If Sherwood's not going to be retained over the summer, and given what we've just been talking about, is Van Gaal the kind of character they should be looking to bring in?
Well, he's certainly experienced. He's certainly built clubs in the past. He might be sort of the kind of cool experienced head that they need. I think Spurs will do well to...
He's pretty combative, mind. He's been known to fall out with people.
Yeah. But I think Spurs will do well to wait until the summer. There's a World Cup. After the World Cup, lots of managers tend to leave their posts at national teams and they might just be itching to get back into club football. And I think, you know, there's going to be a decent pool of candidates.
And Levy loves to do a deal, doesn't he? So
yeah, exactly.
Never mind the fact that will prevent them from planning for next season's transfer window.
Well, Baldini's still in the role. So.
Well, that's very true.
Okay, so from one dysfunctional team to another, Man United, another good win for them this weekend.
Another?
Well, a good win for them this weekend against West Brom. Wayne Rooney on the score sheet. Smalling and Jones playing at the back.
Yep.
What direction has Moyes taken the club in?
I think it's been up for debate in recent weeks whether Moyes has taken the club in any direction.
Yeah.
They've been treading water at best. I think for much of this season, I think clearly the result against Olympiacos was very serious for Moyes and his standing with the fans and with the owners.
Yeah.
And to that extent, I think it's probably, you know, necessitated him to look again at some of the players in the team and who he really wants to prioritise putting in the first 11. And I think you can see that in the lineup that he put up against West Brom, and I think you can see that in the developments that have gone on with RVP as well.
Yeah.
I think that relationship, to me, between manager and player is deteriorating fast.
Yeah. He looks pretty disgruntled, doesn't he?
He does.
Yeah.
And that's despite them winning 3-0 at the weekend.
Yeah.
You know, he looked annoyed to be taken off. He was on the verge of getting sent off.
Yeah.
I think he touched the ball 27 times in the game that he was, you know.
Moyes earlier this season, I think he played RVP. I think it was a game against Newcastle actually, and Newcastle were winning, and he was going to bring Robin van Persie off after 60 minutes because he wasn't fit, he hadn't played for weeks and weeks, but decided to leave him on because he didn't want to feel the wrath of the crowd. Do you think now Moyes is a bit more confident in actually asserting his own authority, and if he's going to bring him off, you know, he doesn't care what Robin van Persie thinks, and he perhaps, you know, isn't going to listen too hard to the shouts from the terraces?
I think it's too early to tell.
Yeah.
I hope so.
Yeah.
Because I don't think he can survive in the job if he isn't.
Do you think his authority will get a boost if he's able to do that?
If he's able to pull it off, and they're able to get wins, definitely.
Yeah.
And it's vitally necessary because I don't think he's had much authority at all in some respects. Certainly in the profile that he's presented to the media, he's been very deferential, both to Sir Alex Ferguson and to the club and to the players. And I think that's probably had a negative impact on him being able to put across his ideas and the way that he wants them to play.
Yeah.
And in fact, I see no evidence, or have yet to see much evidence on the pitch, of him imprinting his style at all on the club.
Yeah.
And I think that's been a big problem. A step forward for me over the weekend was having Jones and Smalling at centre-back.
Mm.
Increasingly, if Vidic is off in the summer, Ferdinand, you know, his best days are behind him.
Yeah.
If I was Moyes, I would prioritise putting Smalling and Jones in a centre half for the rest of the season, yeah, with Evans in there if one of them falls out of form. And I'd likewise seriously consider what you're going to do with RVP.
Yeah.
He's clearly world class, but if he's a disruptive element, if he is seemingly not adapting his play to suit the team, because the team has to come first, then do you drop him?
Big call. They don't have many on the touchlines to replace him. You could play Rooney further up, and perhaps bring in Mata.
Well, this is the thing. So if you were to remove RVP from that equation, as bold and as risky a move as it would be, you would then do open up options for Mata, for Kagawa, for Welbeck, for Januzaj, and for Rooney. And in that respect, actually, it's a part of the team where Moyes has the most options.
Yeah.
If he weds himself to having to play RVP every game, that does constrain what he can do with those other attacking options. And, you know, so it feels rich to me that RVP is complaining about having to compromise on his position when there is no doubt in my mind that Mata and Rooney, to name but two, are compromising on their position to accommodate him in the side.
Yeah, exactly.
They definitely are. And so, you know, and that might be the right thing to do if it's going to get you results. But if it isn't, then I think Moyes has to look at it again.
Yeah. I think he will. So if we're casting our eyes to the summer, we're looking at RVP possibly out the door. You've mentioned Ferdinand and Vidic. What about Tom Cleverley? He's another who's come under a lot of stick from fans, not just Man United fans, actually, but also England fans. We all read about that petition that was doing the rounds on the social media over the past couple of weeks. David Moyes came out and he's defending him. He thinks Tom Cleverley is a star in the making and very important to that Man U side. What are your views on Tom Cleverley, and do you think Moyes is genuine in his defence and that he's got a part to play at Man United?
I do, and I think that in the future Tom Cleverley will go on to be a very important player for Man United and for England.
Yeah,
I really do. I think when he first came onto the scene, when he had a season out on loan at Wigan, when he first came back to Man United, Tom Cleverley was very, very impressive. He's clearly not going through a very good period of form. He's playing in a side that isn't playing very well either, and he's suffering as a result of that, probably. He definitely does not merit the amount of derision he's getting from fans, let alone a petition. And for me, if ever I'm in doubt about these kind of things, I look to people in the game whose opinion I respect and who've got good records and see what they think about an issue. And when Roberto Martinez, Roy Hodgson and David Moyes, amongst many others, come out and say, actually, Ferguson, you know, say, actually, you know, this guy does a lot of important work for the team, and he's got a huge future in the game, I would choose to listen to them over what some numpties on Twitter might be saying.
Because it is interesting sort of what's happened positionally to Tom Cleverley. Because when he burst onto the scene, or when he was out on loan at Wigan, and perhaps I don't know enough about it, but the sense I always got was he played a lot in the final third.
Yes.
And then, you know, since coming back to Man U, he did do a bit of that, but actually he's tended to drop a bit deeper and sitting alongside and quite flat with Michael Carrick, and sort of doing a similar role in terms of ticking the play over. Not really losing the ball. I think his ball retention is pretty good. I think his passing accuracy is up there with the best in the league. But you know, he's very good at helping the team to control the game. Perhaps he does have to look to add a bit more of that attacking threat to his game if he's really going to step up to be a very, very good top midfielder. Perhaps he does need to become a bit more of an all-rounder. And I think he has shown that he's got the ability to do that.
So, I mean, I think on that, I'm not in the Man United dressing room, obviously, but I've seen it reported a number of times that Moyes has given explicit instructions to his centre midfielders to not get ahead of the ball.
Really? Okay.
Yeah. And that actually he wants him, whoever's in those roles, but if it's Carrick and Cleverley, to sit deep.
Yeah. Interesting.
And that might be harming Cleverley's game, or at least it hides what he's doing. Yeah, exactly.
And it hides the perception of his game. And also, perhaps there's something about David Moyes not being experienced at the top level. And perhaps actually he needs to give one of them at least a bit more license to go forward and to express their influence on the game. A bit like someone like Schweinsteiger would do for or Xavi or Iniesta for the top teams.
Well, because there's no doubt when, if you think back to the first games after Euro 2012, when Hodgson had him in his England starting 11, Cleverley was playing like off Rooney, essentially, almost, or off the front. He was occupying these really interesting spaces between the lines, which English players tend not to do very much, other than a player like Rooney. And I thought he had a really good game against Italy in the game after the Euros, where we won 2-1, and he was kind of he was essentially the kind of fulcrum for a lot of our attacking play. The ball would get put into him, he would give it back out, and he was creating interesting spaces. You're right, you just don't see him doing that anymore, certainly not for Man United, and he's now not in the England sort of first 11 or probably, you know, very close to it. But I think in a way all of that, you know, is valid and important, but what we mustn't do is, you know, crush the career of a promising young English footballer.
I mean, it's daft, isn't
it? It's just crazy. I don't think it happens in any other country in the same way.
Yeah, I mean, it's very pointless at the end of the day.
It's just, it's crazy, you know. I don't understand how people can get so vexed and riled about it as to start a petition on social media. The same thing, to a lesser degree, is happening with Jack Wilshere at the moment.
Yeah.
And yes, he's injury prone. No, he's not playing as well as he might, but he's still one of the most promising English footballers, and he's very, very young. Yeah. And we've seen what can happen within the space of 12 months to someone like Aaron Ramsey, for example, who was playing pretty averagely last season, but who really carried Arsenal up the league table for the first 6 months of this season before getting injured again.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden he's a world beater, and yet he was being written off. And so it just strikes me as ludicrous and actually pretty distasteful that we love building these players up and then enjoy knocking them down
before they even got there.
Exactly.
No, I agree with that, and I do like Tom Cleverley. Actually, I think there's a lot more that he can develop within his game. But I think he's a good little player, and I think as others have said, you know, he is able to help control the game. And when you're at a club like Man United, or if you're going to a pretty tough World Cup as England, having people who are comfortable on the ball, they're good at retaining the ball. And if you do nick a goal, he can help you to dictate the pace and tempo of the game and actually control it. That's a valuable asset to have.
And in terms of Man United more generally than James, you asked about their sort of summer activity before.
Yeah.
How many players do they realistically need to bring in? What kind of calibre should they be looking for?
Well, I think the first task for David Moyes will be able to get rid of some of these older players who will no doubt on pretty sizable wages. And you know, he need to free those up. Then I think he needs to look at the forward line. I'm not sure Chicharito is fancied by Moyes.
No.
I think you're right that RVP's days might be numbered. I think if you can form those two out and bring in a really good, high-profile centre-forward, then you're in a good position. I do think they need another option in that holding midfield role. I thought somebody like Johan Cabaye would have been brilliant for them. Unlike Tom Cleverley, he has managed to break forward this season and get amongst the goals, and he is a deep lying playmaker. I think they need somebody like that, and they do need to look at the fullback options as well. I'm not sure that Raphael is the long term answer.
No.
At right back, he is a good player, but his form is pretty inconsistent, and he doesn't play. He's often in and out of the side, and I think what they really need is a solid fullback. Who's good at going forward, but who's good defensively as well.
Quite fundamental then.
Yeah, I don't doubt that he's got a lot of work to do in the summer. And really the key question is not how much we change, but what pace do we change? And whether, you know, if they do a Spurs and they get rid of a few load of players and bring in a load of players, is that going to unsettle the squad? Perhaps. But does the squad need unsettling? Perhaps.
Well, it looks to me as if the squad is already unsettled, and actually his only way of settling it back down again is to put his stamp on it.
Yeah, he needs to break it and remould it.
Yeah. And now it's time for a new feature on the Hit Row Z podcast. We are now less than 100 days away from the World Cup in Brazil, which is very exciting. To celebrate this fact, we are now kicking off a new series of World Cup legend profiles on the Hit Row Z podcast. Here's Adam Widdrington, our third co-editor of the site, to introduce part one.
Hello, I'm Adam Widdrington, and for the first in a World Cup legend series for the Hit Row Z podcast, building up to this summer's tournament, where better to start than one of this year's host success stories? Brazil have always been synonymous with legendary attackers. Rivaldo, Ronaldinho, Pelé, Garrincha, Zico, Ronaldo and Tostão. In 1994, two such attackers formed a devastating partnership that led their country to World Cup glory in the United States. Two strikers who are currently in the nation's top five all-time goalscorers. Romário and Bebeto. Going into the tournament, both players played their respective club football in Spain and both arrived with huge reputations for clinical finishing. Romário, FIFA World Player of the Year for 1993, was playing for Johan Cruyff's Barcelona, with whom he had helped win the league title a month before. He had topped the La Liga goalscorer charts with 30 goals, forming a scintillating partnership with another USA 94 star, Bulgaria's Hristo Stojkov. Bebeto had been the top goalscorer in Spain with Deportivo La Coruña the season before, with 29 goals, but had refused to take a penalty in the final game of the 93-94 season against Valencia, a game they needed to win to secure their first ever La Liga title. His teammate Djukic stepped up, missed, and the game ended in a 0-0 draw, allowing Romario's Barcelona to clinch the league. Their club rivalry seemingly went a little deeper to a more personal level. Romário once branded Bebeto Chorao or Crybaby, believing he had a habit of complaining to referees. The fiery striker also declared in a pre-World Cup press conference, quite bizarrely, that he would refuse to sit next to Bebeto on the plane. This seemed like an unlikely basis for a telepathic working relationship. But despite all of the apparent personal differences, they both had one crucial commonality. A desire to win and an uncanny knack of finding the back of the net. In USA 94, neither disappointed. In Brazil's opening group game against Russia, they ran out comfortable winners. Romário netting a quarter of the game in as a precursor to the eventual victor's intentions. Next up were the indomitable Lions of Cameroon, who were unable to perform the heroics in 94 that won them so many admirers in Italy 4 years earlier. Brazil ran out 3-0 winners, with both Romário and Bebeto scoring one apiece. The partnership being forged was beginning to look formidable, even at this early stage, with qualification to the knockout stages already secured after two games. Romário netted his third in as many games in a 1-1 draw with Sweden, one of the tournament's surprise packages. The hosts USA had qualified for the second round as one of the four best-placed third-place teams, but faced a tough test against Brazil, even with their fervent home support backing them. Bebeto scored his second of the tournament in a 1-0 victory, taking them through to a mouth-watering quarter-final against the Netherlands. The game came alive after the break, with five second-half goals, culminating in an 81st-minute winner by left-back Branco. Once again, Romário had opened up the scoring with his fourth of the tournament, followed in quick succession by Bebeto's third. The rapid striker finished coolly after rounding Dutch keeper Ed de Hooy, and joined by Mazinho and Romário, celebrated with the now iconic baby-rocking celebration in an eventual 3-2 win. At this point, most would have predicted a sumptuous semi-final between Brazil and Argentina, but the latter were surprisingly knocked out by Romania in the round of 16, who in turn were overturned by Sweden in their quarter-final tie. After drawing with Brazil in the group stages, the Scandinavian outfit might have felt they could pull off a shock win, knowing all of the pressure was on their opponents. After a tight encounter, that man Romário eventually found a way past Thomas Ravelli with 10 minutes to go. Roberto Baggio had netted a brace in the other semi-final, as Italy defeated a brave Bulgarian side to set up what would certainly be a memorable final. With five goal strikers Baggio and Romário and three goal Bebeto in the starting lineup, it was almost a miracle that the showpiece final was still goalless after extra time. Penalties would decide the winners of the 1994 World Cup final in Pasadena. After the first two penalties were missed by Baresio and Marcio Santos, Romário kept his composure to level the shootout at 1-1 following Dimitri Albertini's successfully dispatched effort for Italy. Ivani and Branco each netted to keep the shootout on a knife edge, and after Daniele Massaro's miss and Brazilian captain Dunga's conversion, Roberto Baggio needed to score to keep Italian hopes alive. His now infamous skied penalty sent the Brazilians into raptures winning the shootout 3-2 without the need for a fifth taker. Romario and Bebeto had led their country to glory, and given their consistency throughout the tournament, probably deserved nothing less. Romario's stocky and powerful build complemented the more fleet-footed and pacey Bebeto, contributing 8 World Cup goals between them on their way to lifting the most prestigious prize in football, ensuring that they would never be forgotten.
Thanks very much, Adam. James, what's your favourite moment of USA 94, which featured so heavily in Adam's profile there?
Mine's got to be Ray Houghton's chip for Republic of Ireland over Paliuka's head from about, I remember it being from about 25, 30 yards.
Not sure it was.
And that was just a fantastic goal. It was the first big tournament that I watched. And seeing that go in, Republic of Ireland beating the mighty Italy, Roberto Baggio's mighty Italy.
Yeah.
Was just brilliant.
I was in Ireland for that game.
Yeah.
And I had Pat Bonner's goalkeeping shirt. The atmosphere was just fantastic. Yeah. So yes, more of those World Cup legends profiles to come in the coming weeks. You can read a full profile of World Cup legend Roberto Baggio on the site just now. James, what else is up on the site?
We have an article up there on measuring expectation and redefining success. What does success really look like for your club? Interesting article, and maybe pins back to the discussion on Tim Sherwood earlier. And as we near the business end of the season, there's a lot of talk of six-pointers. Cardiff won a six-pointer at the weekend, but does that really matter? Check out our latest articles on six-pointers at the top and bottom of the table.
Excellent. Well, that's all we've got time for this week. Keep in touch with us on the Twitter, which is @hit_row_z. Do check out the website for the articles that James just mentioned and many, many more. That's www.hitrowz.com. But for now, for me, it's goodbye. And from James, it's...
Bye-bye.